Hello everyone and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show on Yoga. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Talk, and on behalf of the Cure Talk Cure Panel team of Sharib Khan and Chintan Patel, I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on yoga. We will be moderating the call and bringing people live on the show. Cure Panel Talk Show is organized by Cure Talk, the blog of Trialex.com, an online platform to connect patients to clinical trials of new treatments. For more information on clinical trials for all conditions, please visit trialex.com/ask. This is the 15th episode of Cure Panel Talk Show and the second Cure Panel discussion on yoga. Our first show on yoga featured Dr. Satbir Khalsa from Harvard University. And today we have with us David Emerson of the Justice Resource Institute. David Emerson will be talking on yoga for trauma. Today's show has been selected to be featured live on Blog Talk Radio. The panel is co-hosted by co-founder of Trialex and yoga enthusiast Sharib Khan. On the panel, we have Marcella Clavijo, Dashama, and Micheline Tolsan. On behalf of the Cure Panel Talk Show, I welcome all of you to the show. We will be taking in calls from our listeners towards the end of the show. Callers can let us know by pressing 1 on their keypads, and we will bring them live on air to ask their questions. Sharib will now introduce us to the experts. Sharib, you're on. Sharib, can you hear me?
Yes, I'm on air now. So thank you, Priya, for the introduction. And I'm so excited to be here on the panel and have such an esteemed expert and panelist to have on discussion today. So let me quickly introduce our expert today, David Emerson, who is the Director of Yoga Services at the Trauma Center of the Justice Resource Institute in Brooklyn, Massachusetts. And he's an accomplished yoga instructor and co-author of the book Overcoming Trauma Through Yoga and founder of the Black Lotus Yoga Project, a non-profit organization dedicated to the teaching of yoga to individuals with post-traumatic stress disorder. He's also on the advisory board of Mandala House, and he joined the Trauma Center in 2006 and helped develop the Trauma Center at the Justice Resource Institute. And in a while, we'll ask him to tell us a little bit about the Justice Resource Institute and also a lot of the work that he's doing there. As a coordinator of the Yoga Services Program at the Justice Resource Institute, he has been responsible for the implementation, supervision, and oversight of the yoga intervention component, and which is part of an NIH-funded study to assess the utility and the feasibility of yoga intervention for traumatized adults with PTSD. He has extensive experience in the instruction of yoga for patients with a post-traumatic stress disorder, and he's worked with various populations, and has also developed and conducted yoga training sessions for rape crisis centers, domestic violence programs, residential programs for youth, and military bases and the Veteran Affairs. So we're very excited to have David today, and with that, I will let David get on air and quickly introduce his himself a little bit and talk about the Justice Resource Institute, and then we'll dive in to discuss his work at the Trauma Center there. David, you're in air.
Great. Hi, everybody. Thanks so much for having me on. Quick introduction to the Trauma Center itself. Was started about 30 years ago by Bessel van der Kolk. And it's really a treatment and research institute focused on PTSD and complex trauma. And over the years, we've done a number of important studies in the field of trauma, and we can add yoga to the list at this point. So at some point, if people are interested, I could talk a little bit about our study, recent studies. And we've been working for about 10 years now, and done thousands of classes and 3 studies. So that's a quick introduction. Let me know if you want more.
Oh yes, that's helpful. Let me ask you to tell us a little bit about how you got started with this work at the trauma center, and what exactly is your work in treating people with PTSD, and how are you applying yoga to address trauma and in patients with PTSD and other situations?
Okay. How I got started, I was a social worker for about 10 years and went back to school to become a therapist, a clinical social worker, and really found that the talk therapy wasn't very comfortable for me. So I was, meanwhile, just had my own yoga practice that was that I did enjoy quite a bit. So I went into that full-time, became a yoga teacher. And over the course of a couple of years, heard about Bessel van der Kolk and the work at the trauma center, just in general. They weren't doing any yoga, but they treat trauma. And I thought it would be a good fit to try to bring yoga into the mix. So the plan for us when we started was we were always going to study what we do so that we could develop as clear a picture as possible about what works and what doesn't work for trauma. And so that was really the project. And what I would say in terms of just a quick overview about what we do with yoga is that the focus is helping people feel what they feel in their body. So the emphasis is your body experience in different forms and noticing what it feels like. And then starting to practice making about what you do with your body. So it's about really taking control of ownership of your body through this process called interoception, where you're just beginning to notice what it feels like to have a body, really. So that's essentially what we do. Using yoga forms as a way to practice having a body and practice making choices.
It was very interesting to read from your work that looking at PTSD and treating it more as or getting the body to start feeling and moving and not just thinking about the mind, which is frozen and in the past experience. And can you elaborate a little bit more on that? And how did that insight come? And where did that? What research showed that this is where we need to focus on rather than just the mental aspect of it? And how you've seen this actually being applied and produce results?
Yeah. Okay, great question. I think from my perspective and our perspective at the Trauma Center, neuroscience is really the key insight over the past 15 years or so that has encouraged some changes in the field. So the brain pictures are really important. What we're seeing is parts of the brain that are involved in cognition, self-reflection, and the ability to verbalize internal experiences. All those parts of the brain are adversely affected by trauma exposure. So if you ask people to articulate what they're feeling, it's, in many cases, especially if we're traumatized, it's really impossible. And if anything, it could be re-traumatizing for people because you can't feel yourself and you can't articulate what you can't feel. So it's pretty much a futile process. And meanwhile, you see parts of the brain that are involved with self-reflection and introspection, and you start to wonder, are there ways that we can engage those parts of the brain to the body? The first research that is really important for us are the meditation research, the Vipassana meditation research by people like John Kabat-Zinn, Richard Davidson in Wisconsin. And that research has shown that Vipassana meditation, where you focus internally, can have an effect on those parts of the brain. So you can start to really rebuild some connectivity there. The thing with trauma is that if we just ask people to sit and meditate, it's also overwhelming. You have to have a pretty healthy frontal lobe to be able to organize all those thoughts that come up when you meditate. So people were getting overwhelmed if they were just asked to sit still. So the beauty of the Hatha yoga is you get to move. You get to move and really start to feel your body, and then you also get to do the mindfulness sort of interoceptive practice at the same time. So that was the underpinning. The neuroscience, some of that meditation research, and I guess that's where we started from.
I mean, that's such a fascinating piece of information that you provided, because, you know, there's in Western medicine till very recent, I mean, even now for a majority of people and physicians, there's always been a mind-body disconnect. And this is a great example of how we can show the body actually can influence the mind, and in turn, the mind is then influencing the body. And, you know, again, as Dr. Khalsa had pointed out in his research, actually, when we were having him on the Cure Talk panel show last time, that there are, you know, what you're saying, that there are actual immediate changes in the neuronal circuits that are immediate as well as short-term and long-term through the practice of yoga. And it's exciting to know that actual research is showing these things more, you know, objectively, what has always been believed and what has also been held as a strong therapeutic focus in Eastern medicine in the mind-body connection. So with that, can you talk a little bit about exactly what the interventions entail, like what happens when a patient with PTSD comes into the trauma center, and then what's the assessment of the severity of it, and then how do you plan the intervention, and what does an intervention actually entail?
Yes, right, absolutely. So first, the first distinction that I think is probably useful for us to make is we really don't treat PTSD. We're treating complex trauma, so we should probably make that distinction. PTSD is symptomology, and in order to qualify for it, you have to have a certain symptom set that we can find in the physician's desk reference. Okay?
Okay.
And so let's say you have a traumatic event, and 1 month later you have a certain set of symptoms, then you qualify for PTSD. Complex trauma is longitudinal. So it's traumatic experiences that happen over time, that were re-exposed.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think of children who grow up in an abusive home, for example, or even these soldiers who are redeployed to these war zones repeatedly. That's the kind of thing that we are focused on, and that's the sort of brain science that I'm talking about. So those are where you see the changes in those interoceptive pathways in the brain. It's complex, repeated exposure. And that's really where our yoga program is focused. Other things we know about complex trauma is oftentimes there's a developmental component. So a lot of it is taking place in the context of relationships, and particularly primary relationships, so your home. There's a relational component to what we're doing with yoga that's actually really important. If you think about, if you look at trauma experts like Judith Herman, she's been talking about the primacy of relationship for 20 years in terms of healing trauma. It has to take place in the context of relationships. So we're focused on particularly the relationship that one has to oneself. And that's another way actually to describe interoception. We feel like if we can help people start to feel themselves, so for example, it could be as simple as wherever you are right now, just notice where the ground is. Notice where you're making contact with the surface underneath you. So that's one example. And then the more complexity there would be muscular dynamics. So the first one is just sensory awareness. And then you get into, you know, what's happening in this form. What muscles do you feel stretching? What muscles do you feel strengthening? So we're focused on that kind of relationship, the relationship to the self. Obviously, it's also taken place in the context of a relationship with somebody else, at least the yoga teacher. So I would say what we're doing is focused on interoception, but the yoga teacher is very specifically not ordering people to do things. So if you were to hear a session at the trauma center, you wouldn't hear commands. So we don't tell people to lift their arm. We're inviting people to lift their arm if they like. So the whole organization is around notice what you feel and notice what you want to do with these options. So if you really start to investigate developmental and sort of intrafamilial trauma, I would argue, I'll just say this is my opinion right now at this point, that if you're not ordering people around but inviting them to experiment with things, you're starting to rebuild relational dynamics, giving people a chance to have a new kind of relationship with somebody in power. So we're really serious about not ordering people around and being respectful of people's choices and options. So that's pretty much it. But it sounds simple in a way. But to stay focused on that kind of practice for months and years, which is what we do with people, it takes a lot of, discipline on the part of the teacher. Sometimes it seems like it's easy to tell people what to do. You'll get it done quick. But in the treatment of trauma, that would be a mistake. You really want to back off and be patient. People have time to feel what they feel and make choices.
That's very helpful. That's really helpful. And we're very interested to actually observe one of these sessions. So with that quick introduction about what you're doing at the Justice Resource Institute and some details on the work itself, I will move on and introduce our first panelist, who actually also happens to be my yoga teacher, and I've been taking Marcella Clavio's classes at the Iyengar Yoga Institute in New York for quite a few years now, and I'm so honored and delighted that she was able to take some time out to be with us on the panel today. So it's a real honor and privilege to have her here. And she is a junior intermediate certified yoga teacher of the Iyengar Yoga lineage, and she is done her yoga training, including various trips to India, where she studied with the Iyengar family in Pune, and also trained with Patricia Walden and Manoso Manos, who are senior Iyengar yoga teachers. She's an ordained Tibetan Buddhist nun in the Saya tradition, and has conducted many retreats at places like Menla Mountain in Phoenicia, New York, upstate New York. Has done retreats in other parts of the country, and also teaches in the city at the Iyengar Institute and the Yoga Works and places in Washington Heights. With that, I will bring Marcella online, and would love to have her introduce herself a little bit, talk about her work as a yoga teacher, and also then ask David some questions about his work. Marcella, you're on air.
Oh, yes, I am. Thank you, Shari. First of all, I'd like to thank you and Priya for inviting me to be on the show. I'm very happy to do this, and it's an honor and a pleasure for me to be able to participate in this with you. And also, I'd like to say hello to David and to thank you for your introduction, and also to the other panelists, to Dashana and to Micheline. Hello, everybody. I'm here in New York City, and it's nice to know that we're all connecting all over the country and all over the world. I think this is magnificent. The first thing would be just, I'm a little picky, and my actual title as a typical Iyengar yoga teacher, we're kind of a little bit fussy about the details. And I am I'm an Iyengar teacher, and it's Junior Intermediate 1. There are various levels of Junior Intermediate certification, and I'm just at the beginning of that. So there's, I think, three of them, and I'm a Junior Intermediate 1. Just for listeners who are interested in these kinds of details, it's not a big deal, but details are also important. And basically what that means is that as a practitioner of Iyengar Yoga, we have a handle on the complete system of yoga in terms of the ethics and the practices, as well as the asana practices, the pranayamas, and the meditation practices. As far as being a teacher, at that level, we begin to present the deeper organic presentation of the asanas to the students who've been practicing and are a little bit more familiar with, say, the sequencing and the physical aspect of the asanas, the more structural aspects of the asanas. We also give them a deeper comprehension of the evolution of the asanas, principles of alignment, principles of function and movement. The asanas themselves, they're deeper, especially hip movement, pelvic movement is presented at this stage, as well as more complex integrated movements of balancing, of weight bearing, and combining that with all sorts of shoulder and hip and spinal movement as far as, you know, what I'm teaching. I mean, I also teach beginners and a little bit more advanced beginners, what we call level two. And at the Iyengar Yoga School, I've been there for about 15 years or so. I'm very happy to say, and I'm proud to say, that I'm still teaching there. And the Iyengars, I think, they're, first of all, they're still alive, which to me is a really important factor, where they modify their teachings based on what they see right in front of them. So we, as an Iyengar student and teacher, I can go right to the source and present a situation, present a problem or a situation I might be having with a student. And they assess and they come up with very innovative and practical solutions based on what they see in front of them. And that means that it's great, but at the same time, it's always changing. For example, a few years back, some postures, we were cautioned to not present some postures to students, but then later on we've seen that, and we've been told that some postures, based on what they've seen with their students in their medical classes in India, are actually beneficial. So it keeps us Iyengar teachers very much in the present moment. We are kind of encouraged to not think about any posture or any sequence or anything that we might present to a student, that it will always be this way written down. We are encouraged to be creative and to always watch our students and help them to recognize, just as you were saying, David, to recognize, help them to recognize their own experience, to feel what it's like to be embodied and to recognize and handle their own physical experience and guide them through that as well. And that helps us also to guide the students. So that's as far as I'd like to say right now.
Yeah, I was just summarizing that's a great introduction, and also, as you mentioned, it fits in so well with what David was saying, that we have to feel our experience and go with the experience as part of the practice. So with that, I believe you have a few questions to ask David as to, so would you like to go ahead with that?
Oh, yes, very much so. Thank you.
Yes.
Again, David, thanks for your wonderful introduction. And I was really intrigued by what you present in your book, Overcoming Trauma Through Yoga. about the four aspects that you present to the students to experience the present moment, to make choices, to take effective action, and to create rhythms. The one that I was struck by that kind of piqued my curiosity was the one about making choices. In light of also what you were describing, the way that you lead the classes where you don't command students, you don't order them or tell them what to do, rather you invite them or suggest to them if you would like to do this and that. How do you kind of guide them, and what sort of factors do you use or considering to guide them toward making the choices that they make?
Thanks for your introduction as well. I learned a lot. It's a great point, and in my mind at this point, I would also consider that practice making choices is kind of the cornerstone of trauma-sensitive yoga, almost in the way that Ahimsa is in many ways the cornerstone of sort of yoga philosophy. To me, the focus of trauma is so much about not being able to make choices, and the impact of that experience on our organism, you know, is not just intellectual, the idea that I didn't want bad things to happen to me and they happened anyway. It's really an organism issue. You know, your brain, your hormone levels, cortisol, and what's happening inside your tissues and your skin, and what's also happening emotionally and physically. So we try to use yoga as an opportunity to get for people to begin to make real choices again. And so it started off sort of as a semi-theoretical experience, like what would it be like to make real choices? And as time went on and we started to get feedback from our students, we realized how important it was to people. And then when we did our study, we just finished our big study, part of it would be qualitative interviews with people. So things like, what happened for you after doing 10 weeks of yoga? And one of the key themes they kept coming back was choice. So people would practice making choices like how high they wanted to lift their arm in a form, or how much energy they wanted to use, and some strength in a form. And then they were saying to us that, you know, then I realized I had other choices in my life. I had other choices in my relationships, in my, you know, my work life, my personal life. So it seems as though the experience of making choices that are feelable within your body based on, you know, body feedback is having an impact on people that goes beyond that moment. So, I'm just qualitatively, people seem to be rebuilding the capacity to make effective choices that have results they can feel. The other aspect of choice, and you know, like just about everything else, is we're trying to attend to the neuroscience that we understand. So if you're making choices about what you're doing, especially with us, it's always based on what you feel. You're starting to engage those interoceptive pathways. It's parts of the brain that, as it was kind of stated earlier, connect mind and body. So by emphasizing choice, we're hopefully, and we have a very preliminary neuroscience to back us up on this. Our next study is going to be a big fMRI study. And it looks like you can start to re-engage those parts of the brain a little bit, too. And we think that's a big part of it, the emphasis on choice and experience.
Oh, great. Thank you. Yeah, that's
That's right. Very, very interesting. Thank you, Marcella, for bringing up this question, and David for highlighting that you have very preliminary neuroscience data that is sort of suggesting this really, not, I wouldn't say complex, but very, very deeply interrelated phenomenon of experience, choice, choice, experience, experience, choice, choice, experience. I'm trained as a physician, and I was training to be a neurosurgeon, so I've always been very interested in the brain and the anatomy and neuroscience. So this is it's exciting to hear that yoga is playing at that level and making those kind of changes happen. So, Marcella, you have one more question. If you can go ahead with that, and then we can pull up Dashyama and Micheline on the call as well, as we're down to the last half hour of the panel.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thanks for letting me ask another question. I'll skip to the last one that I had, which was about if there's a way that you are guiding the students in self-evaluation. In other words, about the choices that they're making and creating rhythms in their practice. Is there a way that then are you giving them any tools for evaluating any progress?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. You know, I would say the way that our protocol works is everything that happens is present moment oriented. So everybody in our programs are in therapy, so they have a place to talk about and sort of reflect on experience. Our focus is on the experience itself. So in the moment, you know, if someone makes a choice, for example, and has an impact that they can feel in their body, we'll try to highlight that. You know, I work with a lot of teenagers, for example, so when one of the kids, does something or decides to stop doing a form and says, no, this was uncomfortable for me, I couldn't really breathe here, so I'm going to stop doing this. And I'll say, wow, that's great that you noticed that and that you were able to make that choice, you know, to come out of that. So we try to emphasize the experience as it's happening and then build that story as long as we have with people. So other than that, we don't do any sort of reflecting or story making around the experience itself. They can do that in therapy if that's helpful, you know.
Mm. Okay.
And, with us, it's really about what's happening right now.
In the present, yeah.
And sort of trusting the body.
Yeah.
My perspective, and this is editorial again, I feel like the body will remember those experiences, you know.
Oh, yeah.
If they're imprinted and kind of genuine, I think that's the sort of thing that your organism won't forget. And so we try to trust that and stay out of the way of the story making, which we do know it's different parts of the brain that get involved in making stories about things, you know, as opposed to having the experience.
Yeah. Great. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for the good question.
We will have some time to have Marcella back with any more questions. I do believe you have a few more things to discuss. I will bring up Dashyama now because she's been having difficulty getting on the call. Actually, she's dialing in from Bali, and she lost her phone in the ocean, I believe, and she's trying to dial us through Skype, and before we lose her, and we are not able to bring her experience and reality into this conversation, I will bring her on. And Dashyama is a yoga and fitness expert with 10-plus years in the industry, training, coaching, and consulting with people and companies. She is a multimedia producer as well. She's made books, videos, and DVDs that have been featured on Oprah.com, Walmart, and are available in Barnes & Noble, Target, and other places. And she has a very popular yoga channel on YouTube, which has grown to have more than 8 million viewers. So we are very, very excited to have Dashyama on air. Dashyama, can you hear us?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, glad to have you. I know you. Yes, we can hear you, and we are glad to have you on the show despite all the technical troubles you had in dialing in.
Yeah, thank you. It's 6 a.m. here in Bali, and so I'm glad that I finally got on.
So please tell us a little bit about your experience and background as a yoga instructor and teacher, and then you can ask David and discuss the topic with David with any questions you have in mind.
Thank you. Yeah, well, it's interesting because part of my journey as a yoga teacher has dealt a lot with trauma and Part of that reason is because I had a lot of my own trauma. I was in several car accidents when I was young, in high school as well as in college. And so it was interesting because I didn't realize that when I got hit by a car this one time on my bicycle, it actually really damaged my cervical spine, and I didn't think about it because I was very stubborn at the time, so I thought it was going to be okay. And then several years later is when I started to develop a lot of stiffness and tension in my upper back and my neck and my shoulders especially. And so that was when I decided to go through the yoga teacher training, and I learned all sorts of things about my body that nothing else had really been able to teach me. So basically, at first, doctors had always told me that you couldn't really help to get the cervical curve back in your spine with anything, really. It would just have to, you know, deal with it. And then when I learned through yoga teachers that you can, in effect, really realign your spine and get it back to its natural curvature, then that gave me a lot of hope. So that was my early journey, and it was interesting because then I would attract who also needed healing as a result of their own trauma. So I traveled around the world and studied with a lot of different healers and masters to develop a very comprehensive lifestyle and healing coaching program and certification program to teach teachers how to also be healers. And that's what we're doing here in Bali. So that's kind of in a nutshell, I guess. An extension of that is all the media that I produce. So 11 DVDs and the 30-day yoga challenge and my online productions and TV that I'm creating and the books. That's all been an extension of just getting the message out, I feel, about, you know, what this has done for myself and also the capacity that it has to really help others to heal and to learn that you can be self-empowered and you can take matters into your own hands and, you know, apply some very specific strategies to be able to heal, whether it's from a physical trauma or from something more on the emotional side, which I've dealt with that in great detail as well, and everything in between, even mental and then all sorts of types of trauma that people go through. And so we really look for the root cause, and then that's where we deal with it from there. So I hope that kind of gives you a little background.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that personal story and journey. And it's really very inspiring to see that how you're taking that as a motivation and to not just delve into the practice, but also now and a mission to actually make it accessible to so many other people all over the world. So please, if you have any questions for David or specifically about how his practice and what his research is showing with relation to healing patients with trauma, please go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a number of questions. Part of my teaching and my journey, I've studied a lot about the psychosomatic connection between trauma or injury and then the physical human journey, the soul journey. So I was wondering, I guess, research and study, do you deal anything on that level as far as the psychosomatic connection to get to the root of it? Or do we mostly deal with just healing the trauma from this point in time forward?
I think our key theoretical underpinning, first of all, it's really cool to be talking to you in Bali. What an awesome world.
Right?
Yeah, great. Our key theoretical underpinning is neuroscience. So we're really focused on the shift, really, and what neuroscience did is shift us a little bit away from cognitive treatments. So things like cognitive behavioral therapy or prolonged exposure for trauma, even psychodynamic psychotherapy, which is talk-based. Because of the insights of neuroscience, we had to start to think a little bit differently about trauma, so the impact on the neurophysiology. So there's that. The other thing I think about from your question is the newest research that I'm aware of is epigenetic research, which is starting to demonstrate some gene mutations related to trauma exposure. So there appears to be some impact on genes that we can then pass on. So there, the story of trauma becomes more and more complex, I think, the better our research tools get. From our perspective, we're dealing with primarily intrafamilial relational trauma. So, what does that do to an organism when you're brought into the world and you're not loved and you're actually harmed by the people who are supposed to love you? And what do you do? You know, what does that do to you, and then how do we heal from that? How do we approach that from a healing perspective? So that's really where we're focused, is, you know, how do we help people sort of reestablish an effective organism, a body that can move through the world and be successful and be in love and be loved, to touch and be touched by your loved ones and have that be safe and maybe even enjoyable. So that's the kind of thing we're using Yale for. And the data we have really three studies that are most recent. There's a PTSD study, which I know I said we don't do yoga for PTSD, but in order to get funded by NIH, we have to look at PTSD data. Then we did a small fMRI cohort. And then we also did a couple of large qualitative group interviews, so individual interviews with people in our studies. So I think when we combine what we've learned from those three, we're starting to get a picture about what yoga can do for in treatment. And what it looks like, what we have is a clinically significant reduction in PTSD symptoms after 10 weeks of yoga. That's the 33% reduction in symptomology. That's really significant. We have fMRI data in a small group that shows changes in these interoceptive pathways after 20 weeks of yoga. And we have these interviews that build a story, if you start to take them all together, of people having body experiences where they feel affected, where they make choices, and then beginning to feel like their whole organism is more effective, and then making change in their life. For example, people saying, after 10 weeks of yoga, I can let my children touch me, and it's not a trigger. I can let my children touch me, and it's actually enjoyable. It's soothing, you know. And that's a huge shift. That's not trauma. If you can be touched by your kids, and that can be like a good thing. That's not trauma anymore in that moment. So that's where we're coming from.
Wonderful. Okay, thank you. Yeah, another question I had, because we really focus a lot on the visualization meditation and enough.
I'm afraid I didn't hear that question. I heard almost none of it.
I think we lost Dashama there. Micheline, would you like to introduce yourself and go ahead?
Can you hear me?
Yes, Micheline.
My name is Micheline Toussaint. I'm coming to you from a much less exotic location. I'm in a suburb of Washington, D.C. And I'm a clinical psychotherapist that works with a lot of people individually with complex trauma, using somatic methodology as well. And then I also teach yoga with cancer patients, and that's sort of the perspective that I'm coming to you from today. And David, I just wanted to thank you for your work. It's been so helpful as I sort of language my classes and sequence them. And just wanted to say a couple of things about how I use some of your four major areas. Your idea about really grounding people in their present moment experience. It has been really helpful working with people who have chronic pain. A lot of the cancer patients in my classes have chronic pain, and when I'm asking them or inviting them to sort of notice their experience, there's a sort of habit of noticing the pain predominantly. Mm-hmm. And so what I've noticed is I sort of have to go a little further, and then what else? What else is there? What else is there? So there's sort of a layered part to that question, because I think there's almost a habitual way of, it's always my pain when I feel my body, if that makes any sense. So that's been sort of one of my learnings, I think, is to just invite them to the next level. There's the obvious thing you feel, and then what else, and what else. And then your idea of the practice of making choices has been lovely, too. Not only just you know, how much you extend your arm or how much you choose to do this. But even we begin to talk about even their participation in a yoga practice as being a choice they're making to participate in their healing. And, you know, that they don't have to do this. This is one of the choices they have. So much of what happens to a person in their cancer journey feels like not a choice, but this is a choice they're making to participate in that. And that seems very powerful for people to feel that, yeah, this is a choice they're making. I had a question. A lot of the cancer patients I work with also have multiple traumas in their lives before this. So this is one more traumatic thing that's happened to them. What feels different about this for them, or maybe for me, is that they haven't yet reached the other side of it, that they're not yet assured of safety. So they're still in the process of getting regular CT scans, and still there isn't sort of oh, wow, I've made it, I can exhale now. And I just wondered if you had any other thoughts. You know, I use primarily the ideas of sort of grounding them in present moment and not getting ahead of themselves too much, wondering about their next scan, but I just wondered if you had any other perspectives or thoughts on that.
Well, yeah, you know, I can relate to a lot of what you're saying, and I think the people I work with, you know, when you're traumatized, you're always under threat as well.
Okay.
It's not like the trauma has ended, you know. I mean, people may be in therapy and may be in therapy for 10 or 20 years, but the trauma is still there.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I'm meeting people. So, you know, the project is really, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. It is to actually have an experience of being present, because when you're present in that way, you're not traumatized, you know. And I think your exploration with people of it, you know, of what do you notice, what do you feel, and then if people feel overwhelmed with pain, seeing if you can shift, you know, maybe the form is enough, and then there's something noticeable, or maybe within a form there are some small shifts that can be made. But I think that's what you do, you know. You explore with people. We have to kind of accept. We have to accept and respect the amount of pain people are in, and then be willing to kind of go into it and with an open mind, you know. Well, maybe it's all pain, or maybe there isn't all pain. What if you do this? Mm. What if you do that? You know. So, you know, there are times where it may be helpful to, even though it's all choice oriented always, to give people maybe a variety of choices if it's not overwhelming, you know, things to try, things to experiment with without any expectation of outcome, you know. I think it's important that we don't feel like we know what's going to happen. We don't know. And I think if we don't want to sort of pretend that we know, and then let people have an authentic experience and let you, and tell you what they're feeling, what they're noticing. You know,
mm-hmm.
And there are times where people may be so deep in pain that that's all they notice, and that's, you know,
yeah.
that's true.
Yeah.
But maybe there'll be a time, if you probably had the experience, you know, of working with someone for a while, or where they notice something else. And then when they do, we can just point it out. We can just try to kind of highlight it, you know.
Yeah.
And then build those experiences as they go, you know, just kind of building on those new experiences.
Thank you, Priya, over there for stepping in. We were trying to bring Dashama back, and I wasn't able to introduce Micheline, but Micheline, thank you for the introduction and the conversation with David. If you have anything else, please feel free to add. I think we might be able to pull in Dashama back into the call despite her terrible internet connection over Skype. Micheline, if you have anything else, please go ahead.
I wanted to say to Dashama, I will volunteer to come and dive into the ocean in Bali to look for your phone. So I just wanted to let her know that. But I think the only other thing that I wanted to add, and again, this is sort of coming out of the yoga tradition, just the importance I have found of the languaging in the final shavasana. Just especially as I work with many people sort of towards the end of life, even, you know, sort of in a bed where they can't move at all, but just the power of that languaging of just, you know, feel what's holding you, what's supporting you, literally, whether it's the bed or the mat and the floor, just evokes a quality of being held in a much larger sense. And I just, working with this population has given me such an understanding of languaging and the power of that, and how it can evoke so much more than just the words themselves, if that makes any sense.
It makes sense to me. I can tell you the same. Yes, I mean just if you want me to comment at all, I totally understand. I think you're right. Yoga teachers use a lot of language, and it's incredible how much language, you know, you use, even 15 minutes. And I think we have to pay really close attention to what we say, especially in the context of trauma, you know, or the work you're doing, because people are hearing your every word. And not only hearing it, but they're taking it in. They're taking it into their body, and they're interpreting it through their body experience. And what we say has a tremendous impact. You know, and I think what we say, but also like where it comes from in us, and like what our motivation is, and so to be as clear as we can be about that is really it's a big part of the work of being a trauma sensitive yoga teacher.
Mm. Well, and if I can just share one example of learning from myself, that even I had sort of a habit of, during a different part of class, usually toward the end, saying something like, just scan your body for blah, blah, blah. And I know just one day I noticed a woman just kind of jerk with the word scan. And I realized, oh, for cancer patients, that can be a real trigger word. So it's just sort of so I try not, you know, I just sort of move your awareness through. But I feel like I'm constantly learning that a word that for me might be fairly benign might evoke something quite different for people. It's fascinating to continue to learn that.
Well, that's your willingness to notice that and to learn from that is fantastic. And we're all going to make mistakes, right?
That's a brilliant, point that you've shared with us, Micheline, that how the word scan can be having different interpretations. And there I will actually bring on Dashama and Marcella both on air, and ask them to add any of their comments on this particular point itself, like how language is interpreted and how what they have experienced in their own as a teacher, and what they have experienced, the effect of language on their students. So Marcella, would you like to add something? And Dashama, please add something after Marcella.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Sharib. Thank you so much, Micheline. That was really very helpful. And thank you for sharing your own experiences and your learning curves. I think that as teachers, and I sometimes even kind of lightly joke about it in my classes, I'm the student, I'm the one who's learning from them. And my experience has been that as important as language is, it's also the tone of voice that you use. It was something that David, you were talking about, was watching our own motivation, you know, where we are in relationship to the students, to the group, to the class, to the studio, because that is operating all the time. We could say the right words, but if the tone isn't right, if we're not really relating to them as equals in a way and offering to them tools more than orders or instructions to take a shape, that's what they're going to hear. And that we are in a very strange way talking to their bodies, and they're receiving our energy, how we say the words and how we, our body language, our the expression in our face, if we look at them in the eye, if we don't look them at the eye. These things are so crucial that, in my experience, can enrich the experience with the student, or it can also undermine my best intentions at getting the perfect sequence or the perfect points or the perfect words. But this other nonverbal aspect is also really important. And language is crucial, especially in the Iyengar scene, where our training is so strongly in guiding students to do things. I really enjoy giving students the chance to explore, hey, try this. What does this feel like? Do this and trace the results of your action, and have in a classroom setting, also have a conversation so that they're being guided as to what they're doing and what they're feeling, and then continuing from there. And I find that really, really important. Also, touching students, if we're going to make an adjustment, how we approach them, asking permission to touch them, asking permission to use them as a model in a class or not. Also, all of these things are so important in class. And you're absolutely right, David. We're going to make mistakes, and we just have to keep learning from the mistakes and be as humble as we can in our mission to offer what we learn and what we can to help other people.
So you can make it quick. I would like to bring any of the callers who might want to have a quick question from David. So, Dashama, if you have anything to add for the next 30, 40 seconds, and then we can bring the callers on air if they have any questions.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I was trying to ask earlier. My question was as far as using visualization techniques and that level of meditation practices to the yoga practice to heal trauma, because that's been very effective in my work, and I wanted to know what kind of research they were doing with that right now.
Yeah, we don't use any visualization, or we don't even use metaphorical language. A lot of that is because we know parts of the brain that help you organize metaphors and thoughts and ideas are really, really compromised by trauma exposure. So we keep it really focused on concrete, visceral, so body-oriented, feelable experiences. And we know that people are dissociating all the time in our classes. And for us, visualization kind of practices or even metaphors would really just enhance dissociation. And we're trying to get people a new experience other than dissociating. What is it like to actually be in your body in the present moment. So that's our focus.
So with that, if any callers would like to ask a question, please press 1 on your phone, and we will get to know that you are interested, and we'll bring you on air. In the meantime, Priya, I believe we have some questions submitted by our listeners in advance, and you might want to ask David before we run out of time. We'll last couple of minutes. We'd like to touch upon at least a question from one of the users.
Yes, thank you, Sharif. David, one of our participants wants to know, if you have a lot of arthritis and you're not flexible, would yoga benefit you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm not very flexible. Yeah, I think it's, you know, the forms are really secondary to the process and the experience. So, you know, it really doesn't matter at all. It's much more about what you feel, what you notice, and what you experience in your own body and the choices that you make.
Okay. There is another question, and it is like, what are a couple of yoga breath techniques that might be helpful for relaxation?
That's interesting. You know, with trauma especially, breathing is such a big part of trauma exposure. So when we're traumatized, we learn to breathe in certain ways to protect ourselves from implicit body memories. So we're very careful about breath. The focus on breath for us is just noticing that you're breathing and feeling some of the muscular activity involved with breath, but we don't do any breath retention or anything like Kapalabhati or anything aggressive at all. It's because, partly because of dissociation and partly because people already know how to retain their breath. You know, we try to keep it moving and very simple.
So we are up with our allotted 60 minutes, but let's do a quick roundup. So, Marcella, 10 seconds if you'd like to add anything, say anything before we end the show.
Well, first of all, just to say again, thanks to everybody, Priya and Sharib and David and Darshima and Micheline. It's been a real pleasure to meet all of you this way and to hear what all of you have had to say about this topic. And I'm so happy that we're doing all this research and that we're continuing to expand the ways that we can help people through yoga. And that's all I want to say. I'm so happy that this is happening. And thank you all for
participating. Oh. Sorry, we got cut with Marcella. But Micheline, would you like to wrap up with any concluding thoughts?
Just, again, thank you for being part of this, and I agree that this feels like a very exciting time to be a part of yoga and trauma work. There just feels like just so much happening that's being discovered. I'm just very grateful for all the work that's being done in this area, so really grateful to be a part of this tonight.
And I believe we've lost Darshima, but David, again, thanks a lot for... for taking the time out and for telling us such important things about choices and how they influence the mind-body connection, and also Marcella and Micheline and Darshima, thanks for sharing your insights. It's really helpful. So all this is going to be recorded, and Priya will send you the link to the recording, and welcome to share it with folks, and we will be having our next panel next month, and we will be in touch with you with another expert on the science of yoga. We'll continue the discussion and have more panelists joining the discussion. So thank you once again. Very, very excited to have you all, and hope to have you in the next panels going forward.
Thank you. Very nice.
Thank you very much, Sharif. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Priya. Thanks, everybody.
Goodbye.
Yeah.